Group meeting, Saturday, 17th October, 1981. Last month, we considered in depth the meaning of the word samadhi, which is usually translated as meditation in English, or sometimes concentration. And we saw that the word meditation, which ordinarily means musing, is a very inadequate word for samadhi. The word samadhi represents the supreme meditative state. The supreme meditative state, a state in which there is the cessation of all the activity of our thought and speech process. And in that silence, there is the realization, the making real, realization not in the ordinary English meaning of understanding with your brain, but the making real, the experience of what the Christian mystics call the Unio Mystica. It comes into being when the psyche, utterly pure, silent and still, offers no obstruction to the free functioning of mind through your own psychophysical organism. I have said this over and over again, but one or two people who may not have been present, it would be useful to repeat it for their sake. Mind is a universal archetypal expression of the primordial creative energy. We talk very easily about my mind, his mind, a brilliant mind, and all the rest of it. But that's all nonsense. There is no such thing as my mind or your mind. This universal energy coming in, interacting with the physical body, gives rise to your own psyche. Your psyche is specifically yours just as much as your heart or liver or your kidney or your eyes are yours. And your psyche is that which expresses the ordinary mental life, the feelings, the thoughts, the moods, the ideas, the study and all the rest of it. I think it is very helpful to look at the situation this way, because otherwise we would fail to understand in a somewhat profounder degree, with our brain even, what the meaning of samadhi is. Samadhi is that state where mind comes into its own through you, the individual. That which is infinite, eternal, and immortal functions through you, the individual, who are finite, temporal, and mortal. This is the extraordinary thing that happens. And this is something quite different from the usual idea people have about meditation, that it is musing. This is the dictionary meaning in the English dictionary, musing, or paying attention, thinking over a particular subject as such. Now, I mentioned that it is necessary for the psyche to be completely purified, to be still and silent. And the importance of silence must not be underestimated. Most people do underestimate it. And as far as the practical fact of their ordinary lives is concerned, we know how the 4,000 millions chatter ceaselessly all day and every day, and also during their sleep. That is to say, not, I don't mean they speak out, speak aloud, some do, but the dream state is just this endless chatter which is going on. I think probably the earliest mention of the importance of silence comes in the Zarathustrian Gathas. In Yasna, the Gathas, the Zarathustrian scriptures consist of 72 Yasnas, as they are called. You might translate that as chapters. In chapter 43, verse 15, there is this extraordinarily pregnant statement: silent meditation is best for attaining spiritual enlightenment. And you know that in all the great religious systems of religious discipline, silence is a very important part of the discipline. You know how for the Greeks, for instance, they had for the first 2 years the akoustikoi, those who listened and only listened. They just kept their mouths shut. And gradually they also learned how to, and this applies to every other such religious system, one also learns how to let the chatter of the brain sizzle down. No, one sizzles up, doesn't it? To just calm down, completely calm down, so that there is no turmoil in the psyche. This is very, very important. In Psalm 46, verse 10, we have the outright statement, "Be still and know that I am God." In the Upanishads, particularly Upanishads like the Mandukya, the Tejobindu and the Varaha, great emphasis is laid upon the importance and the absolute necessity of silence if one wants really to realize the culmination of not only the religious life, but of the practice of meditation, or if you take the theistic religions, what is called contemplative prayer. Silence is absolutely necessary. The Buddha always told his disciples, when you are gathered together, any talk which deals with worldly matters is unworthy of you. Either talk on the Dhamma, the teaching, or maintain the Aryan silence. In Christian mysticism, the origin of quiet, which culminates in the rapture and ecstasy of the contemplative mystic, realizing the Unio Mystica, is emphasized very strongly, this origin of quiet. And it's really wonderful to read in detail what the great Christian mystics have said about quiet. There is hardly anything to choose between their realization and what was realized in Asia. It's all there. You will find it in great detail, and in some instances the very language is identical where certain phrases are concerned with the language which has emanated out of India and China. Now, what is the significance of the pure state of the psyche? What does it actually imply? First, all the defilements of the psyche, as the Buddha called them, are out. They are no longer present in the psyche. The psyche is utterly purified of all the defilements. And in the discourses you will find a long list of these defilements, what we commonly call the vices, and so forth. All of them are completely out. Next, there is this you won't find. in the purified psyche, there is no reaction of lust and greed to any impulse or stimulus which comes to us or arises from within us. No reaction of anger, envy, malevolence, hate, fear. Now, can we imagine that state of the psyche, so utterly pure? There is freedom from all illusions and delusions. We are all full of various delusions, especially our strong convictions. They have, practically none of them have any warrant whatsoever in truth. They are just our particular ideas, our bees in our bonnets, as the Buddha himself said in the Brahmajala Sutta. And these delusions and illusions associated with them give rise to a great deal of trouble and a great deal of conflict between man and man. I mean, we see it particularly in the conflict of ideologies in the world and in the conflict between the adherents of one religion as against another. Their doctrines, their teachings are opposed to somebody else's doctrines and teachings and so forth. But all these dogmas and doctrines, although they are an attempt to clothe the truth in an appropriate form, do not succeed in doing that. And the verbal formulation is usually somewhat and in many cases very misleading as to what the truth is. Also, there is no stupid action, no vested interest in the purified psyche, none whatever. Particularly, we must bear in mind that there is no vested interest in the passion to attain perfection or to realize nirvana or to serve God or enter the kingdom of heaven or any such thing whatsoever. We have to be free from all that. We start with an aspiration towards it. But when the psyche is purified, that aspiration has taken on quite a different form. It is no longer an aspiration for oneself to attain at all. Absolutely none. One just naturally is that. So one may take as an analogy, a person who has born with a gift for poetry or something. Well, he can aspire to become a great poet. And when he is a great poet, he just naturally writes great poetry and that's that. There is no vested interest for him to write poetry, unless it be to produce a little bit of LSD, which is necessary sometimes. Now, so this is the soil. This purified psyche is the soil in which meditation flowers. We all realize that as we are at the present moment, we are not exactly in this state. In the state where there are no defilements in the psyche. There is no reaction of anger or greed or possessiveness, malevolence, hate, etc. That there is freedom from illusions and delusions. One proof of that in our lives is just this. You know how easily when we are in our teens, we are perfectly certain we know all about this, that or the other. We are quite confident with regard to our views. You see, and when we are in our 30s, we say, well, In my teens I thought that way, but perhaps it needs a little modification. And in our 50s, there is a very considerable modification. And when you come to the 80s and 90s, there is a complete modification of the whole thing, you see. And one sees that the truth, the deep truth of oneself and of reality and the purpose of our existence and its fulfillment and all that cannot be put into words. It just happens. It happens if we let it happen. And the letting it happen is the whole meaning of living the religious life. Now, because we are what we are to start with, our starting point is constant mindfulness. That we must clearly realize. There are, I suppose, hundreds of people, thousands of people who are interested in living the religious life, following some discipline or other. In Buddhism, we talk about mindfulness. Jesus said, watch and pray. Watchfulness. In the Zarathustrian teachings, you have the same idea given, to be perfectly mindful of everything and see that one lives in terms of the good thought, the good word and the good deed from day to day. In Hinduism it's the same, this idea, this teaching of mindfulness. Because without mindfulness it is impossible to begin to know ourselves at all. So the starting point is mindfulness, and it has to be constant. People sometimes are surprised at the degree of constancy which is emphasized in the scriptures. Both in the Upanishads and in the Buddha's discourses, you will find it. Find him pointing out that this mindfulness can extend to the sleep state. There was a Jain called Satchaka who came and had a long conversation with the Buddha. And Satchaka tried to catch out the Buddha about losing mindfulness when he goes to sleep. And the Buddha said quite categorically that he sleeps perfectly mindfully. He is aware. Now we may wonder, what sort of awareness is that? Awareness is something which quite transcends, it includes and quite transcends our ordinary brain awareness in our waking state. Our brain awareness is the result of the functioning of our senses, the impressions we receive, which are interpreted by means of the language which we have learned by the brain. You see, all those impressions are interpreted by the brain. But that is just the photograph of the reality. It is not the reality itself. It is a picture only. This deeper awareness, which can come to life in the sleep state, is something which has to be experienced in order to be appreciated. It is a sort of a directive meditative activity which goes on. You may ask, who directs it? You, the person who bodily are asleep, but inwardly are awake, because in your ordinary everyday waking state you have practiced mindfulness constantly. And that power of mindfulness makes a very great difference to that period of the sleep which is ordinarily the dreaming state. And you will find that you will be free from dreams. If you sleep mindfully, if you can develop the power to sleep mindfully, you'll be free from dreams. That is to say, dreams of a very special sort may be present, but they will be more sort of precognitions and deep insights rather than the sort of dreams that we do have, which are an awful muddlement usually. You see? So, the mindful state persists constantly, and it will persist right up to the very end in the actual realization of the Unio Mystica, the actual realization of the perfect samadhi. There you'll be mindful in the transcendent way, the way in which is untrammeled by the setting up of thoughts, thought forms, and the using words. This is something which one has to experience, and you may experience it for a little while suddenly, even without having gone very far, having developed very far with your practice in mindfulness. Because sometimes these things just happen to one. Now, the mindfulness has to be pure. So many people carry out these disciplines in order to obtain a result for themselves. For one thing, they predetermine the result, and their predetermination is invariably a false predetermination. They've got the wrong end of the stick. They don't know what they are trying to predetermine. There must be no desire for personal benefits or attainments whatsoever. You practice mindfulness because that is the thing to do, just as you breathe quite naturally. When you meet a friend, you say hello quite naturally, and so on. So in the same way, you practice mindfulness perfectly naturally, not desiring anything whatsoever for yourself or expecting a reward or a gain for the self. That is, anything for the self is that which completely defeats the fruition of one's human nature. Human nature, not subhuman. You see? It has to be pure observation, just bare observation. And one has to observe not only that which is conveyed to one's brain through the senses, but the response from the brain to what one is observing. This is one of the most important parts. This is part of real meditation. Observe that response. Don't criticize it. Don't praise it. Don't censure it. Just observe it very carefully in order that one may know it in its actual inner nature, the truth of it. It's like the really great scientist whose observation is a pure observation. If he has any hunch about it, which he would like to see fulfilled, or if he has any ulterior motive in carrying out an experiment in a particular way in order to get a desired result, then his experiment will go wrong, or he will come to a wrong conclusion. So it has to be absolutely pure mindfulness. Also, with mindfulness, don't carry out mindfulness as if you are on guard against evil or danger. One can't deal with evil if one tries to run away from it or be on guard against it. Face it fairly and squarely, completely, to the very end. Supposing you had hypnotic power with your eyes and you met a hungry lion. And if you can stare at him You'll outstare him and he'll go away. I haven't tried it, I don't know. But this is what I've been told, that is what happens. It's the same with evil. You have to look at it, absolutely look at it. And in that looking, that pure looking, mind you, not as a result of fear, don't be petrified with fear and stare at the evil that way, but just look at it, and you will dissolve the evil element in it. You will convert that evil into a pure energy, because evil is an energy just as good is an energy. You will convert the energy of that evil into something good by such observation. So we can see, therefore, that we must be free of observing with our observation must not be interfered with by our particular standards, our judgments, our evaluations, our criteria, and so on. It has to be a wholly open-minded inquiry into that which is. Now, this kind of mindfulness, what the Buddha called samasati, the perfect watchfulness, reveals to us just what we are. It's a tremendous task. It's a very difficult task. But if one means business, one will persevere and one will find an extraordinary sense of inward poise, an inward strength and stability that way. And it will not only tell us what we are, but it will tell us what the world is like. And we shall see that I am the world, the world is me. You see, our inveterate egoism makes us say, oh no, it's the world which is doing all this, I am different from that. We separate ourselves out from the world. The evil done in the world is my evil. It's done by the agency of the other fellow, all right, but it is my evil. I have contributed towards that and I keep on contributing towards it. In what manner do I contribute towards it is the thing that I discover by intense mindfulness, by a very pure, honest observation of the whole situation. We have little idea how responsible we all are for the world's troubles and the world's evils, as well as the world's achievements and the world's good. We are responsible for that too. But we are also responsible for the evil, and what we have to clean out is not the good. That would be like throwing the baby out with the bathwater. But it's the evil that has to be cleansed. And the cleansing process is a very difficult and a hard task, actually. Now, if we do see that the world is me and I am the world, then we will cease from criticizing others. We will also cease from applauding others. We will cease from criticizing ourselves and applauding ourselves. As an example of how we tend to cut ourselves off from the world and say, oh no, the world is doing this, that, and it's not me, you see. That's what we say to ourselves inwardly. People say, I hate the sin and not the sinner. Mahatma Gandhi, for instance, said that we hate the sin, we don't hate the sinner. Now that's absolute nonsense. With due respect to Mahatma Gandhi, that's absolute nonsense. If there were no sinner, would there be a sin? in recognizing and in hating the sin which emanates out of the sinner, I am hating the sinner also. Isn't that so? I hate the sin and not the sinner. You can't do it. It's a self-contradictory statement. There must be no hate whatsoever at all. One sees the fact as the fact, and one recognizes that which is evil, that which is harmful, hurtful, that which prevents human fruition and fulfillment, and the reverse of it. We must see the fact as the fact and take no sides. One of the important things that the Buddha says in connection with the Arahant, he says the Arahant is incapable of partiality. And partiality can be either on the side of the wrong thing or the right thing. One has to be incapable of partiality. See? So now, if we do see all these things, then we find that an extraordinary peace and a purity permeates the whole psychophysical organism. This promotes the conversion of discursive meditation, musing as we call it. We have to start with that, of course. It promotes the conversion of that into true meditation, into pure meditation. Now, pure meditation is a movement of consciousness in its own transcendent sphere. That is the pure meditative activity. The movement of consciousness in its own transcendent sphere. That is pure meditation. That is the supreme contemplative prayer of the theistic mystic. That is, if you like, of the nature of God. Remember that when we use the word God, we are projecting God out of our own brains. We have a picture of God and so forth. But we can free ourselves from the limitations imposed by that picture by being able to enter this silence and to be completely still. Being completely still means not only that the body doesn't wriggle about, but it means that there is no turmoil whatsoever in the psyche. And all the turmoil of the psyche comes through our defects. You see? So, what starts as musing, which is silent chatter after all, it's only a verbal ritual which one follows. You look at all the meditative systems as laid down. They are verbal rituals. But all those are just nothing at all. They don't mean anything in themselves. They are there in order to help us to become steady psychophysically. They do help there, otherwise they wouldn't have lasted through the ages. They do help there. But when that inward steadiness and poise begins to assert itself throughout the organism, then it is possible to enter the true meditative state where all thinking, all thought forms and words have completely ceased. When the Buddha said, talked about the Aryan silence, he was asked, and his great disciples were asked, what is the meaning of this Aryan silence? And it is stated quite openly. You'll find it in all the Nikayas, particularly also in the Anguttara Nikaya, the fifth one, the fourth one. You'll find it there, that the Aryan silence supervenes at the second jhana, the sort of second stage of meditative activity. The first stage is what is called vitakka vichara, that is concentrating attention upon the chosen subject of meditation, and there you look into it. First of all, there'll be a lot of talk about it, and then the talk about it will simmer down, and there will be a mode of perception by the quiet psyche which is near allied to true mental perception. Intellect in its purity begins to function there. And then that too ceases, because that too belongs to the realm of conceptualizing. All conceptualizing ceases. All words cease. You are fully awake. You are fully conscious. The Buddha repeats again and again, clearly conscious. That's the term he uses. You see? And then it is that which is the silence. You have passed, as I put it in the Heart of Religion, through the first portal of death. Now, the death of what? The death of all psychical disturbance. That's the first passage through the first portal of death. The entry into that silence. And from there onwards, one enters into profounder and profounder intensities of consciousness. It is not like climbing the rungs of a ladder. That is a bad, I think that's a very bad simile. You don't climb any ladder upstairs. Your ladder has nothing to lean against. You are in the void, actually, in that meditative state, you see. So don't climb the rungs. That state becomes intenser and intenser. It is like a light which becomes more and more brilliant all the time. And it's the power of pure mind functioning through you, and it purifies the whole psychophysical organism. It actually changes the brain cells. It changes the body chemistry, the activity of the way the ductless glands act and so forth. Because when the psyche is completely purified, the ductless glands won't react in the same way as under ordinary conditions. If you suddenly come across some sort of danger, your adrenals will do something and so forth. You know that, don't you? And the ductless glands function that way in the ordinary way. But when you have realized this state of complete quiet and poise from within yourself, and the psyche is purified, you are just yourself, absolutely untouched by any evil, any difficulty, any danger. You are untouched by it. Right. So, now, during our attempts at discursive meditation, we will come across various interferences and difficulties. We'll deal with that next month. So at present, I think we have quite enough to go on with.